And today Mildred is also the epitome of nervousness. Don't ask me why, but that's just the way it is, so I'm here anyway, not running away from whatever. My name is Mildred, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I hail from across the border in Canada, and I bring you greetings from all my fellow Canadians, one of them whom is here with me, and that's a great pleasure. I have to come to Atlanta to see Mari. Isn't that something? We were just talking about the fact that we don't see each other very much in Toronto because. So, my dry date is May the 18th, 1973. My home group is the Rocks Glen Traditional Group in Toronto. I have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor even as he is dying. And so, it's a great pleasure to be here. I have been asked, by the way, thank you, Dick, where are you? Watching the game? Shame on you. You wouldn't do that, would you? I see you waving. Now I lost my train of thought. I want to thank you, Dick and Barbara and your committee for, it's a great pleasure. A great pleasure and a great honor to be here. And whether I like it or not, it's a great pleasure to be speaking on the subject of 8 and 9. And I remember the first time I was invited to speak at a Woodstock, and I think it was Bob D. who asked me. And he said, make sure that you don't spend your time just telling your story, that you share where you were at the beginning and where you are now and what that progression is about this step. So that's what I'm going to do. But for you to understand that progression, I do have to tell you a little bit about myself. I was born on a farm in Saskatchewan. I was the youngest of 10 children. We were Roman Catholic, obviously. And I hated everything about my life because very early on, somebody used to crawl into bed with me, and she'd cry at night. It was my sister who, that time, they said was retarded. They didn't know what to do with her, so they kept her in grade 3 till she was 16. She knew she was different, and she didn't know what to do about that, and she cried. And she came to me for comfort, and she'd say, why was I ever born? And I'd say, why was I ever born? Now, I've got 8 big brothers and sisters who adore me, who have petted me all, as far as I know. I'm the apple of their eye, and I ask them to fix the thing that I have a problem with. And they don't. And I misunderstood that. I thought they didn't because they wouldn't. I know now they didn't because they couldn't. Big difference. But I grew up thinking, nobody cares about me. The way I saw life, even at that early time, it wasn't 10 people as a family. It was 8 plus 1, Dora, plus me, Mildred. And so I didn't realize what I did at the time, but I put up walls because I felt so alone. I felt I didn't fit. I felt nobody cared about me. I felt nobody cared about the things I cared about. And I spent my early years running after people, saying, why don't, after little girls, maybe little boys too, I don't know, but little girls for sure, saying, why don't you want to play with me? Why don't you like me? I have money. I'll give you money if you'll play with me. The tears almost come up to me as I say that, because that's the story of my life. Please, please love me, and I'll give you what I want. What amends have become to me is getting my spirit back, calling my spirit back from all the places where I sold it, where I gave it away, where I shouldn't have given it away, in an effort to get somebody to like me, somebody to make me feel okay. What I didn't understand was that there was a God, and that it was really all about God, and that no human being can fix me, and that ultimately that's where I have to go. That's a long journey. I put up walls. I wouldn't have called it that, but that's what I did. I put up walls finally because it was too painful to try to be in the world. And so my attitude was, well, if that's the way you are, if you won't make me happy, see if I give a damn. I'll find a way to be okay. And I can tell you, I paid a heavy price for that. I said I never fit. I had one weapon, and it was my intellect. My intellect, which proved to be a weapon in some sense that helped me, but in another sense, it was my downfall. Because as Bob so eloquently spoke this afternoon about trying to figure things out and analyze things and thinking you could make it okay, it's what Dr. Silkworth calls the sense of ease and comfort. And that's what I chased for the next 35 years. And it took me to a park bench, and it took me to Skid Row as well as the convent. And I can tell you that there isn't much that I haven't done to get that, because that was the only time I felt okay. That was the only time that I felt a part of you. And I felt that I belonged on the planet. So at 18, I went to a convent. I went there for a lot of reasons. I went there because I was afraid of life. I went there because I was making a deal with God. I went there because I was running away. And so I went to the convent. I was drunk the night I entered. They took me anyway, which says as much about them as it does about me. And I stayed drunk those 15 years, but I functioned. And that's why nobody ever questioned me. After 15 years, Mother Superior called me, and we got my dispensation, and I left the convent thinking life was as simple as taking off a habit, getting my secular name back, being dispensed from the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. I was a well-educated young woman. I had had the opportunity to study music and philosophy and theology and psychology. I knew a lot of stuff. But I remember standing on the convent steps January the 10th, 1966, and I didn't know a thing about life because I thought that it was as simple as changing the outside. And what I was to find was that nothing had changed. I needed to drink. And now I no longer wore the black robe and all of that. I found the bars, and in the bars I found the men. And I don't have to tell you that for the next 10 months I lived a life of such utter debauchery, I can't even believe that that was me. I wound up in jail, and I don't know how an ex-nun winds up in jail, but I did. And the chief of police wasn't impressed when I asked to speak to him, and he came down to the cell that I was locked up in. And I told him he couldn't keep me because I was an ex-nun and I would call the bishop. He said, I suggest you call a good lawyer instead. At the end of that time, by this time I had been locked up in psych wards 32 times. I had had 38 electroshock treatments, and I tell you, that will put a light into your life. I had had hundreds of hours of therapy, and I didn't have a clue. I signed myself into an insane asylum, and from there I went to the West, and there I got into AA in 1966. I'm not giving you all the details. You don't need those. But Dr. Hoffer was a friend of Bill Wilson, and he intervened in my case, and he said, she doesn't have all these psychiatric illnesses. She's an alcoholic and should go to AA. I have a brother who died sober 49 years, and I remember the day my father called to tell me my brother had been transformed. He's in this new organization, this wonderful new organization, AA. So when Dr. Hoffer said, I think you should go to AA, I was excited. I went to AA, I'm going to get transformed, and I waited 3 weeks and I wasn't transformed. And so, I didn't feel good. Nothing had changed. You know, I get creeps when I hear people say, just don't drink and go to meetings, you'll be fine. Not true. See, I wasn't drinking and I was going to meetings and I wasn't fine. And I know how to change how I feel. So I sat in AA 5.5 years stoned, and after that I drank again. And this is the time when I met that man, Cease Corrigal, that Clancy spoke of last night. He was my first sponsor. There weren't any sober women out there at the time, and I was glad to have a man sponsor. I drank again and wound up on a park bench. I had married my psychiatrist in the meantime. That's not a smart thing either. You're sick, you know that. You particularly. Laughing at such a sad situation. And May the 18th came and the police picked me off a park bench. We had lost everything, so I spent the last 3 weeks of my drinking career on a park bench selling my body. And the police picked me up and took me to a psych ward, and it was there in the morning of May the 20th that I made a decision to kill myself because I had no solution. I was out of everything. This was the way I was looking at life. No friends, no family, no nothing. And I don't know how to do the life. I haven't got a home. And I made up my mind to kill myself. I wasn't feeling sorry for myself. I was just done. And I asked the nurse to get my clothes, and as she went to get my clothes, the unbelievable happened. It felt to me as if a hand reached into me and took the compulsion and the obsession. And that was May the 20th, 1973. And in all this time, I have never had it back. God's grace is an amazing thing, and it comes to us when we open the door, and no door is wider open than the soul that says, I don't know how to do it. I'm done with my old ways. And I remember thinking, I don't know how to live. You'll have to send me somebody. And there was a rap on the door, and honest to God, there was. And a man stood there, and he said, I saw you at breakfast. I came to offer you some help. And he told me about a hospital, which was, there were no treatment centers in Toronto at the time. And I went to Donwood, and from Donwood, I went to Skid Row. And the first year that I was sober, you're serving that, I hope. The first year that I was sober, I swept a factory floor and lived on Skid Row. And I'm not going to go into that except to say that after 6 months of that, one day somebody invited me. I went to the institution, and somebody invited me to a meeting. I didn't know where I was going. And it was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I fell in love with you. And I had got a sponsor. She had blonde hair, gold earrings, a white suit, and I thought she was made for me. And she did teach me something, that I could stay sober regardless of what anybody else did. And I did. And she got drunk, and I don't know where she is. Two fellas stepped up, and Polly, thank you for talking about what you talked about this morning, about doing the steps. Those two fellas took me aside and said, you won't stay here if you don't do the steps. You're too sick. And I said, I don't know how to do the steps. And they said, we'll read the book to you, because I was broken. Despite all my education and so on, I couldn't read two sentences and know what I had read. And they took me through the steps, and I did the steps. I did what I was told. And something happened to me the night before I did the fifth. I got an inspiration. I understood something. I understood that you were not my problem. And I know that as clearly today as I stand here and look out at you. If I'm disturbed, I'm the one that has to change, not you. But that's a long process. Intellectually, I can say that. But how do you live that? So these two fellas took me up to about, we finished, I think, about step 7, and then I got a sponsor. I got a sponsor who was a man, and he didn't care whether I was a woman or a man. He had a size 16 shoe, and he didn't care how I felt about what he said. He said, I will tell you, I will lead you through the steps, I will lead you through the program, I will not run your life for you. But he said, if you do not want to do the things I tell you to do, he said, get another sponsor, because I'm done with you. So I marched, and we got to step 8 and 9. Now, I've told you this because I think it's important that you realize what kind of person I was. I wasn't a nice person, not in here. I was a person who was always full of blame of everybody. I was a person who was filled with those old belief systems. I'm not okay. There's something wrong with me. I'm not important. Nobody cares about me. I'm a great believer, as I stand here today, that somehow or other you read my energy. Just like when you open an email, you read what's in there. You open a physical present, you see what's in there. And when you interact with me, you read my energy just as I read your energy. And so you can see that with that kind of belief system, with the values that I had, with the idea that you should fix me, it's your fault, even somehow or other, I still clung to that. If life had been different, if you were different, I'd be okay. So we get to step 8. And my sponsor made me make the list. I made the list. And he told me to get the 2x3 papers, and we talked about each person. Now, I've had sponsees. I found this piece difficult because I hated the world. See, in step 10, Bill says, he describes how we come here. He says, we love but a few. We're indifferent to the many, as long as they don't cause us any trouble, and the rest we just hate. Well, that didn't apply to me totally. I didn't love anybody, and I wasn't indifferent to anybody. I was just mad at the whole world. How do you make amends for stuff? It took some real talk on the part of my sponsor so that I could see the part that I had played. I wrote down some things. He had me try to make it manageable. So we found out that I had cheated. Imagine that, Polly. On my husband. In AA. I had lied. I had stolen. After I was in AA, they made me the secretary of the group, and I stole from the group. How do you like that one? I was cruel. I was mean. And I had been unloving. So he said, we've got to start someplace. So who did I do that to? Like, how are you going to go to the world? Am I going to go into some office and say, hey, I was unloving to all of you? It doesn't work like that. So we looked at family. We made the list. Family, certain students that I had taught, certain people in the convent that I felt that I had been particularly sharp with. And after we did that, he talked to me about forgiveness. And he said, before you go to make those amends, we have to forgive everybody. If you have a grudge against anybody, you're not going to make an amend, because all you will do will just exacerbate whatever is going on for them. It will not be a God deal. See, I think the big deal with an amend is I'm trying to get right with God. Step 8 and 9, it's not pre-step 1. I've gone through step 1 and learned that I'm powerless. I've learned that there's a power bigger than I am. I've learned that I'm giving my life into the care of that loving being who has taken the compulsion and the obsession. I've made the inventory. I've done step 5. I've shared that with somebody. And I've made some attempt, not like Bob was discussing, but I've made some attempt to do 6 and 7 and to ask for some help. So I'm not, as I said, I'm not pre-step 1. I believe that on page 77 of the book, it says, our next function is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and those about us. That's part of what 8 and 9 are about, to get right in here. To understand, you're a God being, but you also live in this body. And for now, none of us is perfect. We make mistakes. And I have a choice. I can look at you, and I can look at what's wrong with you, or I can choose to look at you and say, you are a divine being. Maybe you don't know it, and you have made mistakes, and I set you free of those. How else are we going to take a look at this? You know, and as my sponsor reminded me, he said, surely to goodness, in all your years in a convent, you looked at a crucifix from time to time. Well, that's the understatement. He said, do you remember what that fellow said as they were crucifying him? Like, what had he done to deserve what he was just going through? And he said, Father, let them go free. Forgive them. They don't know what they're up to. And so my sponsor did a lot of work with me on that so that I could go with a more or less free soul to do my amends. My family, they were ecstatic. It wasn't a big deal. I can't say that I had a great revelation, because I think my sponsor and I had done the work before I went. And most of my family, their attitude was, thank God you're sober. You're doing good. We're just happy to see you the way you are. I paid back the money. I had stolen a great deal of money over the years, fudged things one way and another. It took me 7 years to pay all that back. And at the end of that time, my sponsor kept me on a tight rope. I wanted to buy new this and new that, and he'd say, is the money paid back? No. Well, then let's pay some more back. That's the way I was sponsored. I want to talk about two amends that I made in sobriety. Some of the toughest that I've made have been in sobriety with people in the program, and one was a sponsee. She and I had had a bit of she always said, you know, I helped her a great deal, but somehow or other we kind of snipped at each other, and one day I decided, I'm going to make an amend. I want to clean that up and see if we can change that. I wasn't sponsoring her anymore. And my sponsor at the end of each amend had me say to the person, is there anything you need to tell me? And if they said anything, to zip this up. So I did this beautiful amend for all the things, you know, all the times I was sharp and all this. And I thought, I bet when I get finished, she'll make an amend to me too. And this will be just wonderful. So I make this beautiful amend. Here's to you, folks. I said, is there anything you need to say to me? And she said, yes, there is. She said, you're a jerk. She said, "My father told me there'd be people like you on the planet. You talk a lot about spiritual values, but you don't always live them." And she took several strips right off my hide. Thank God for great sponsorship, because I kept it shut. I thanked her, and to this day, I thank her for that. It was a message I needed to hear. And I need to be mindful as I do things. Am I walking the way I'm talking? A second amend I've had to do, and this one was about 7 years ago. And this one, it felt as if it was going to break my back. A young man had come to me and asked me to sponsor him. And he had been sponsored by a friend of mine. And he said, "I really like the spiritual work you do, etc. And, you know, I know, men for men, women for women. But my sponsor said, you know, Mildred, when you get to be your age, they're not after your body. They really..." He said, "So go ahead." And I, you know, I wasn't careful. I think one of the things you learn through this is people matter. And getting out of self is not about sitting there meditating. It's about seeing you and seeing how what I do affects you and seeing if I can do it better. I wasn't careful. I said to him, "You have to talk to this sponsor." And he said, "I will." And the days went by, and it came to be, I didn't ask him if he'd done it. "If you came to me today, I would say, you fix that up first, and then I'll take you on." I didn't do that. So it was coming to his fifth year medallion. In Toronto, we give medallions at 5 years. And what I realized was, this former sponsor was expecting to give this medallion to him. This hadn't been cleaned up. And it made for some very bad feelings between me and that friend of mine. I hid. I said to the sponsee, because I knew that I'm the adult. I should have taken care of that. I said to him, "Let him give you the medallion." And he said, "No." He said, "You're my spiritual sponsor." He said, "I want you to give it to me." So I had to swallow whatever I had to swallow, go to the meeting. I gave the medallion, but I knew that my two friends were really annoyed with me. I hid in this fetal position for 4 days. Till I could pick up the phone, and I knew I had to make it right. It took me 4 days to do it. 4 days of prayer and meditation and whatever else it took. And I picked up the phone, and all I could do was bawl. That one really cost, I can tell you. But they were very gracious, and you know, it felt to me at the time, I realized how much I love Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I do stupid stuff sometimes. I realize how much I value the respect that people have for me. I realize, probably you're the same, that you really value the respect people have for you, and that when you march out of tune, you gotta make it right. And that's what I had to do. That was, I think, the toughest one of any of the amends that I've had to do. Okay, time goes on. I'm a little ahead of myself. I spent those first 20 years paying off the debts. Then I got a teaching job when I was 1 year sober. I got off Skid Row. And at 7 years, by a God shot, I started buying and selling houses. And for the next 12 years, I made a lot of money. I say that because somewhere in my awareness, one of my values was, if you have a lot of money, they're going to know you're somebody. They're going to love you. Remember, I've got these old belief systems hanging around. I'm nobody, I'm not important, nobody really cares about me, etc. And I thought, boy, if I get this big house, and then they're all going to come for coffee, and I'm going to bake cookies and cinnamon buns, and it's going to be just amazing. It didn't work out that way. 18 years I'm sober, and I'm sitting in my fine, custom-designed sofa. My red convertible is on the driveway of my beautiful house, and I'm bawling. I'm not okay. I don't know what's wrong. I just know I don't feel okay inside. We have a slogan at our meeting, "You are no longer alone." I used to sit there and I'd hear people say, "I walked in the door and I just knew I was no longer alone." And I'd think, bully for you. Because I didn't feel like that. I was glad to be there, but I didn't have that sense of oneness and that sense of feeling okay. And I'd go to the older members. They'd say, "Go to more meetings." I went to more meetings. It didn't solve it. And one day, one of the older members came to my house, and this is what he said to me. He said, "You know, Bill Wilson said this, that we've had experiences buried below the level of consciousness. At the time of these occurrences, they have given our emotions violent twists, which have since discolored our personalities and altered our lives for the worse." And I said to him, "You shouldn't be saying stuff like that. It's, Dr. Bob said we should keep it simple. That's too psychological." He said, "Get your 12 and 12. So I went and got my 12 and 12. And right here in step 8, here it is, where Bill says, "You might find that in doing amends, you haven't harmed other people that much." But he says, "Use this opportunity to get to know yourself." And, you know, he's pretty explicit about it. He says, "While the purpose of making restitution to others is paramount, it is equally necessary that we extricate from an examination of our personal relations every bit of information about ourselves and our fundamental difficulties. I'm saying that because I always felt when I did those amends, you know, like Polly said this morning, you can only give what you have. And I was still behind my walls when I did those amends. And I always felt that it was incomplete. And so here I am, 18, 19, 20 years sober, and I'm falling apart. And this man comes over and he reads this to me. The most amazing thing happened. We talked about this, and he said, "I think you need to look at some of the stuff that you've got buried in there. Clancy last night talked about the difference between the intellect and the emotions. And I'm saying that if it's a belief system that I've got buried and something I'm telling myself intellectually, I'll tell you right now, the stuff in the unconscious wins out every time. I can stand there and that thing gets stirred up that says nobody cares about you. And you can stand there and say, 'Oh, Mildred, we love you.' And I, yeah, fine. But I know what I'm hearing from in here." Now, I didn't understand all that. That was in May. The beginning of July, Espansi and I were going to the cottage. And she said, "I've got a tape I wonder if you'd care to listen to." I've had enough. We're going to have some fun. I said, "Let's just listen to some music, etc." And that's what we did. We watched movies all weekend, ate popcorn and whatever. And on Sunday night, driving back to Toronto, I said, Why don't we listen to that tape now? It was a tape of one of the members, and in it he was talking about the bondage of self. And he talked about how in his childhood he had learned some things, and he said, I never understood this. He said, I set up this business, and he said, it just never went anyplace. It was okay, but he said, I'd bring a management consultant in, and they'd say, I just don't understand why this business isn't flourishing. And he said, somebody took him through a process, and he said he began to understand that as a child, he had learned this old belief, I'm not okay, things are never going to go right for me, etc., 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 and somebody had helped him process, and that's what he called, like he said to me, you say the third step prayer. I said, certainly I say the third step prayer. And he said, doesn't it say in there, relieve me of the bondage of self? He said, whose voice are you listening to when you hear the voice that says, nobody loves me, it'll never go right for me, I'll never be successful, I'm not important? I'll tell you how important these voices are. And see, what I think is they are the voices of the false self. I don't think the false self just hides out in a little can somewhere within. It's that part of us that we hear that comes up when life happens. And the voices that I used to hear were those. Nobody loves me. I'm not important. I don't matter, etc. And that's why I'd go to you. And if you were a man, yeah, I'll give you sex as long as you care about me. You take me places. You do things for me. That's where I sold my soul. And that's why I had left pieces of my soul strewn on the planet. See, and I'm not talking about the, what do they call that thing, the inner child? That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about false beliefs that I need to take charge of and say, no, you are not the truth. And so I phoned this man, and he said, come. And I went and spent some time with him. And when I came back to Toronto, I was a different person. Oh, I know you don't change totally overnight, but I was a different person. By this time, I had a woman sponsor. I had grown healthy enough to have a woman sponsor. And she said to me, what have you been doing? She said, your energy is completely different. I want some of what you have. And, you know, I often think we misunderstand this. If I send you a gift, a physical gift, you open it and there's dog doo in it, you get a message from that. If I send you an email, and in that email I say some nasty things, I don't like you, I think you're this, I think you're that, you get that too. Do you mean to tell me that the energy of my spirit, the energy of my thoughts, isn't read by you? I don't believe that. I think you read my energy whether you know it or not, and I read yours. And just think what I'm doing. All my life until this point, when I was about 21 years sober, the way I looked at you was with criticism, with dislike, with judgment of how you were, and I wondered why the world didn't like me so much. I understand it today, because you read what I was putting out. I know today, you're not my savior, you are not my happiness, and now I can look at you and see you quite different. See you as my spiritual advisor said, these are God beings. These are divine beings in these bodies. And if you can see that, then you treat them accordingly. Not by how you judge them. Give up your judgments. Give up. Be careful of your choices. Be careful of your ideas. And that changed me. That's the work I believe today. Because I have many times experienced what would happen if somebody would trigger one of those old beliefs. You never knew when I showed up who was going to show up. You never knew if it was going to be somebody sweet-tempered and pleasant, or if it was going to be somebody who was sharp and difficult to deal with. So that was a big thing that happened to me. See, I was saying to Lee before, I did my amends as best I could when I was about 3 years sober. But I had to get to step 8 and find out what Bill wrote here about that stuff that's buried below the level of consciousness, because that's what he experienced. In one of his writings, he said he learned from his childhood experience, he better be number one, because if you aren't number one, you're nothing. So that was one of the important things. I believe that if I am sincere about what I'm doing here, God never makes a mistake. I will make mistakes, but not God. And I think God is a little bit like the GPS. It gives me instructions, and if I make a wrong turn, it says, recalculating. And I get another chance at it. Somebody else shows up in my life. When I think about the years that I've been sober, I have to say this, and you, Tom, were the one who really put me onto this way back when we were both speaking at a conference in Stratford, Ontario. And I'll just paraphrase. He said something about that his plans had not materialized, but as his plans went up in smoke, he realized there was a divine being guiding him. I can't tell you, Tom, how many times in my life I have thought of that, as things that I thought should happen went up in smoke and something else took place. I retired when I was 21 years sober, retired from the teaching. And I hadn't really prepared for retirement. And I found myself very depressed, and it was at the time when this other stuff was stirring. And I got a call after 3 weeks, and it was a Jesuit saying, I'd like you to come and give a retreat. I said, do you know who you're talking to? He said, yes. I said, don't you know how many times I've been excommunicated? He said, I don't care about that. He said, I want you to come and give a retreat. I promise you that in my wildest imaginations, I had never, ever thought about giving retreats. Me? Not in your pig's eye. So I went to give this retreat to 75 women. I did not know that my destiny was waiting for me there. The Sunday morning as I was giving the last talk, I can tell you, I don't cry, or at that time, I didn't cry in front of women. I know how to shed a strategic tear with a man to get my way. But to cry in front of women, to bawl in front of, there's a difference between crying and bawling. This was not pretty crying like they do in the movies. You know, their face doesn't get squished up and their makeup stays on. I bawled. I hadn't planned it. And I'm standing there in front of these women saying, I am the loneliest person in the world. I don't have one friend in the world. Got lots of acquaintances, but not one friend. And as I said it, honest to God, I felt the walls just crumble. All those walls I had hid behind. I wouldn't let anybody near me. Probably Mari remembers those days. And I wouldn't let you in, and I couldn't get out. And there I am, and it's all exposed to the very people. I felt like a chicken with no feathers. And you know, it was the greatest gift, because I couldn't put those walls back up. The truth was out. I'm not that creature behind those walls. I'm just a person, just like you. I cry too, and I'm lonely, and I want to be with people, and I'm not that image that I had defended so drastically. And I learned that morning how wonderful people can be. I wonder how many of those women I had put the walls up to, how many of those women I had slighted. They didn't come at me and say, go get lost. They came and said, would you come and have a cup of coffee? And the phone started to ring. And it was the beginning of a new way of life for me. Oh, you know, I still put up the walls once in a while. I can still do that, but I'm a different person. And what I realized through this process was this. I didn't have the capacity to care. I could act as if I cared, but I didn't have the capacity to care, to feel. I'm not going to say, put up your hand if you identify with that, because that's not your thing. But I'm telling you, I didn't have the capacity to care. And after the walls came down, I began to realize that. There's a difference between caring in your head and caring in your heart. And that is the gift that has come to me. That 18-inch trip from the head to the heart. And so I'm in the process now of making amends again. I come from a family of 10. My mom and dad are gone, of course. And 7 of my brothers and sisters are dead. And their spouses are gone. I have one 93-year-old sister who lives in Vancouver, and she's going strong, baby. And I have a sister in Saskatchewan. And as my heart opened up, I began to just feel the pain of my brothers and sisters being gone and realizing how wonderful they were. I come from a really great family, and I didn't appreciate them. And it came to me. I've got 35 nieces and nephews. You know, yeah, AA is my family, and that's right. And some of you, like Bob and others, you're like my brothers. And that's family too. But I've got blood family. And so 2 years ago, I stopped in. I made a special visit to Saskatchewan. And so my niece called together my nieces and nephews, and they were having a dinner at a hotel. And before we ate, I asked if I could say something. And so I talked to them. And I told them what a great family they come from. And I told them what a bad actor I had been. And all the disgusting things I did, leaving the church, leaving the convent, all the times I did terrible things in that hometown. And how never once did any one of my brothers or sisters ever criticize me. Their only approach to me was, "We love you. Is there anything we can do for you? All you have to do is lift up the phone and call." And I told them that. And I said, "You should be so proud to be who you are." And my nephews and nieces sat there and bawled. So we had a Kaltoff crying spree. And now they're starting to come and visit me. About 2 weeks ago, one of my nieces and her husband spent 4 days with me. And that has changed. So that's one piece that I am so grateful for, that those amends, I can let those kids know what a great family they come from. Some of them came to me after a while and they said, "I didn't know my father was like that. I didn't know my mother was like that. I didn't know that part of their life." So that's one piece. Another piece is, you know, my brothers and sisters are gone. And when they were alive, I wasn't the person I am now. And I never told them how much I loved them. I didn't feel that love for them, but as I look back now, I just come from a stellar family, a wonderful family. So I've started writing letters to them, short letters, telling them how much I appreciated them. And one of my teachers said to me, "Light a candle. When you get your letter ready, light a candle, ask their spirit to come." And so that's what I'm doing now. And there have been so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I took for granted. Wonderful, wonderful people like Reen that, you know, that nurtured me and that taught me. And so many people like Wes Parrish, Chuck Chamberlain, you know, and I could go on with that wonderful crowd. So I've got a lot of letters to do. I need some pens. And lots of Kleenex. And I'm really making an effort to watch the choices I make. As somebody said, somewhere in the universe, every choice that we make, every thought that we think is recorded. And I'm either putting out the goodness that St. Francis of Assisi spoke of. I am either allowing the energy of God that is within me to circulate. I used to put out anger and judgment and criticism. And how do I make up for that? I can't pull all of that back, but I can now put out some goodness. And so I can be careful about my prayer and meditation and my spiritual reading. So I stay conscious of that. And that as I walk the planet today, because that's really what I think amends are. How can you be sober and walk the planet if you've constantly got to be looking to see who's on the other side of the street or who's in the back of the room or whatever. It's a nice feeling to walk free and not have to look to left and right because somebody might be there who doesn't approve or somebody I owe money to. That was one more story. When I got sober, I had no home. And so once I got a teaching job, I didn't have an address. Well, it's kind of embarrassing, you know, to try to sign up for your teaching job and where it says address, say the streets. So I called my sober brother. I had asked him once before for money when I was in jail. He said, you got yourself in, get yourself out. I tried him again and I said, I need an address. I need a room. And he sent me, I think it was $650. And in 1973, that was a lot of money. And somehow or other, I paid everybody else off, but not him. And you know what happened? We stopped communicating. I stopped communicating. And then I'd get a Christmas card. And one day, I got the ball. Well, I got something. And I sent him a letter, and I said, you know, I'm sorry that I did it this way, and I sent him a check. And he sent me back a most beautiful letter. And he was very precise. He said, Mildred, I'm so glad you did this. Do let us, both of us as members of Alcoholics Anonymous, resume our relationship. He said, by the way, there is interest owing on that money. But he said, that's a gift. So, that's my story about amends. And that's been my journey to an open heart. And with that open heart, I tell you, I love you. God bless you.